You're listening to The Weather Junkies.
Oh, boy.
Large wedge tornado coming up in Tuscaloosa.
A winter storm warning is in effect for our area.
We can expect at least another 2 to 4 inches overnight.
Good Thursday evening, and thank you for joining us here on the Weather Junkies. I'm Tyler Jankowski here in Connecticut, joined alongside Dakota Smith in Colorado. Dakota?
Good evening, everyone. Out in Fort Collins, Colorado, we got about an inch of snow on the ground. And it's still, I think it's lightly snowing now. Stark difference from last week, and even a stark difference from yesterday where we basically hit 80 degrees. And now we're sitting just below freezing with a nice wet 1.5, 2 inches on the ground. That's pretty much what the entire Front Range saw. Denver saw a little less than Fort Collins and Boulder, but it's pretty fun for snow of the year, one of the later snows of the year. I think it was the third latest accumulating snowfall for Denver and the second or third for Fort Collins. But we'll talk about that a little bit in the tweets. Tyler, how is the weather in Bristol?
It's very good. We had more than an inch of rain in Western Connecticut on Tuesday. My weather station here says like 0.4 inches, but I've seen a lot of other observations of an inch or more, so I'm not sure if I need to look into that or not. But today, the Drought Center issued their update, and the big buzz here in southern New England was that the extreme drought was expanded far to the south and west. So almost half of Connecticut now in the extreme drought, also portions of the Hudson Valley in the Catskills. But the drought updates, as you may know, are issued on a weekly basis, and the analysis of the data ends at 7 a.m. on Tuesday. So not that it'll have a big impact, but none of the rain that we saw on Tuesday was included in the update. So I don't think it would have a major impact because it's only 1 inch and we average about an inch a week. But I think maybe the extreme drought would have been held off for a week or two if they had included that rain. But the big trend of dry weather is going to continue, I think, for a while, at least for the next week or two. And while the 1 inch is helpful, it's nothing when you look at the 20-inch deficit that we have dating back to May of 2015. And so a lot of the talk today was about reservoirs and where people are standing in terms of the drought. I know in Bristol, I talked to the superintendent of the water department on Monday, and he said that the reservoirs in town are at 42%. They were at 50 a month ago. So in a month's time, they've gone down by 8%, which is quite a lot. I know a lot of other places are up near like 60 or 70. So we're a city of 60,000 here. And it's a guess, but I don't think the water system has changed much in the last 100 years. So it'll be interesting here over the next couple of months.
Yeah, our drought actually got upgraded this week as well. I think in Fort Collins, or just south of Fort Collins, we're in a severe drought now. We got our first accumulated precip in a really long time here today. And it's same thing for here. It doesn't really look like we're going to get that much more, at least in the next week or so. And that's really hurting a lot of the ski places out here. Not only is it warm, but it's not really snowing that much up there.
It'll be interesting to see how much of an impact this has on snowmaking. But last year in the Northeast, the big thing was the warmth. This year, who knows, it may be the warmth, but it could also be drought and lack of water, which would be a killer.
Yeah. Yeah, drought seems to be a problem right now for a couple places, including the Southeast. And we're actually joined by someone from the Southeast tonight in Sean Milrad. He's in Daytona Beach at Embry-Riddle. Sean got his bachelor's degree in atmospheric science from Cornell, and then he went to McGill University in Montreal to get his master's and PhD in atmospheric and oceanic sciences. And now he is a professor down at Embry-Riddle, doing a lot of teaching and some research down there. Sean, thanks for joining us tonight, and how's the weather?
Yeah, thanks, guys, for having me on. Pleased to be here. The weather is about as perfect for Florida as you can get. It's about 60 degrees right now. It was in the mid-70s today, and actually, when the next trough passes on Saturday night, they're forecasting us not to get out of the 60s on Sunday, which down here is generally referred to as parka and chilly weather. So I've already seen people planning chilly recipes and what heavy jacket they're going to wear on Sunday. So that's we're kind of south of the drought. I know Alabama and Georgia and Western North Carolina have had fires and are in exceptional drought, but we're really sitting around normal. Obviously, the hurricane probably helped with that earlier in the fall, but can't really complain this week, that's for sure.
Yeah, do you like having I don't know. I would feel weird without not having like a real winter as like a snow guy. Does that bother you, or are you not that big of a snow person?
Yeah, I mean, I'm from the Northeast. I do miss I do miss seeing snow, and I do miss I miss fall more than anything. I mean, we don't like it'll get. I guess our winter is probably what most people in the mid latitudes consider sort of early to mid fall, but we don't get you know, the changing of the leaves and that the fall feeling during all Halloween and apple picking and all that stuff. So that stuff I miss more than the snow. But I miss snow seeing snow. I don't miss shoveling it quite as much. But
yeah, it becomes kind of a nuisance sometimes.
Yeah, and there are some perks to wearing shorts in November on occasion. Yeah, so
definitely. So we'll get back with Sean to talk about teaching and earth sciences as our topic tonight. But first, let's talk about some of the things that was trending in the Weather Enterprise this week. I'll start off with the first tweet tonight from Josh Larson. He's a writer for Weather 5280, and he tweeted, "To put that in perspective, today's high low of 80 and 57 in Denver compared to the normal high low 50 and 24. So basically what this is saying, this was yesterday, and our high was, this in Denver, was 80 when the normal was 52, and the low was 57 when the normal low is 24. That 80 degrees broke the record temperature for any November day, record high temperature for any November day in Denver. So a lot of records were broken across some of the southern plains and Front Range. And now we're dealing with snow. You know, everyone says, if you don't like the weather, wait 15 minutes. That's true in a lot of places, also in Denver, where we see these swings like that.
Isn't this a tumultuous time of year? Aren't you used to going from snow to sun and warmth?
Yes.
And this is an extreme case of that?
I'd say we're used to it. And yeah, this is one of the extreme cases. And I actually like winters out here because you have a big snowstorm go through, and then, I don't know, 2 days later, it gets into the 50s and it's sunny, so it doesn't feel that bad out. But it came a lot later. This is, you know, first snowfall of the year. It's pretty late for out here.
Our next tweet comes from Brian. He's on Twitter at climatologist49. He's an Alaskan, and his tweet is a photo of a moose in what looks like a yard next to a Davis weather station. Current observation in Midtown Anchorage, partly cloudy, 21, big effing moose. What would that be in a meat bar?
I actually saw someone pretend to write it up in a meat tar. I wish I had
a tweet.
Yeah. Yeah,
Have you guys ever seen the Canadian METAR that says cloud to the north looks like a puppy? That's a real Canadian METAR.
Wow, I've never seen that. Ago.
Yeah, some of the northern Ontario in particular, they have some interesting observations when the weather is boring and it's cold and dark and
Got to entertain somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah, so thanks for that tweet, Brian. He tweets a lot of really, you know, very informational stuff. And, of course, we picked this one with the big moose in it. we'll move on to our next tweet from Zach Labe. He's a we share a lot of stuff on here a lot. You can follow him at ZLabe. He's a student right now doing a lot of – I think he's doing a lot of climate research. We had him on the show in the summer. His tweet says, "This is not normal. Global sea ice area," and then it shows a figure of the global sea ice area for every year since 1978 over the course of that year. And then he shows this year in a red line, and we are at a time low for this time of the year for a global sea ice area. And it's not even an all-time low. It is just, what is it, the scale? It's markedly lower than any other time of the year, or any other year for this time of the year. Tyler, I know you had a few thoughts on this.
I retweeted it. I thought it was a great way to present the information. You see, oftentimes with climate stuff, a line that goes away from other lines, but this one struck me as very different. Do you know which pole is the biggest or the bigger contributor to this anomaly?
I actually don't, but I know they both are.
Yeah, they're both included, which is good.
For the time of the year, I don't know. I want to say it's the Arctic, because it, went through a bunch of melting in the summer, and now it's starting to refreeze. But I don't know. I would think it's the Arctic. I don't know. You could probably scroll through a few of his tweets and find.
Yeah, I think they're both at. Sorry to cut you off. They're both at minima for the day. I thought he tweeted that both the Arctic and Antarctic are at minima for the date.
Which yeah, I think is you're I think right about that.
Yeah, why it's highly unusual.
And we don't have it included as a tweet, but I think he or someone else tweeted a temperature line for maybe the North Pole and how it's just like jutting off to the right instead of going down.
Yes.
So it definitely coincides with less ice.
So I have his sea ice departure plot up here. And it shows the total anomaly and the Arctic and Antarctic total anomaly. And they're actually about the same. They're both at negative 2 million square kilometers. I think I'm reading that right. And sea ice extent. So they're actually equally contributing to this. So interesting. Interesting and kind of a... shocking.
Oh, I see a tweet here about the temperature where what looks like the climatology line continues to go down and the observed line is just pretty much constant. In the most recent observations, it's actually rising. I wonder what this ice anomaly, what type of impact it'll have on the United States winter, if any.
Yeah, I'm not smart enough.
Well, I saw there was a temperature, a story from the Capital Weather Gang about the alarming temperature anomaly up there.
I saw that.
So it'll be interesting. I mean, last winter was terrible here for ski areas. It was the warmest winter on record in December. I was just looking at the stat today. The warmest December by like 5 degrees over number two. So if we have another winter that's quite a ways above average, it'll be a disaster for the ski areas. Anyways, that's an extended Twitter discussion.
I'm gonna take this last one away, Tyler.
Yeah. Gozar. We've been talking about it for a few months, had a little bit of a hiccup there with Matthew. And this tweet is not just a tweet about when the satellite launches. It's actually from the space flight account of the Weather Service. And the tweet says the United States Air Force 45th Weather Squadron is giving a 90% go forecast for goes are on Saturday. And if you actually click the link, they have a PDF prepared of the forecast, even a phone number for the launch weather team. But basically they talk about high pressure persisting over central Florida, favorable weather. They have all sorts of good stats, and the forecast is valid from 5:42 to 6:42 Saturday evening. So they have an hour window that they've issued this forecast for, and it looks like the satellite's going to launch somewhere in that window, I would think.
Yeah, I think it's supposed to go up at 5:42 is the planned, but it looks like the cold front will hold off until late Saturday night. So I think it should be a go. I mean, normally when they launch from Cape Canaveral, we here in Daytona can see the launch. It looks like kind of just a streak in the sky, but I know like our student AMS group is driving down to the next town over, Cocoa Beach, basically, and planning to view it. So it seems like unless there's a technical glitch, it should be a go.
It's time to get the long exposure camera shots ready to go.
Yeah, that's for sure.
I know I shouldn't be, but I am so nervous for this launch, just with how 2016 is gone as a year.
That's probably why it doesn't need a number until it's up there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everyone was freaking out here.
Oh, yeah.
Everything was freaking out here when the hurricane passed, because they were afraid it was going to damage, because the eye passed within 25 miles of Kennedy Space Center, but
yeah,
they had it in a bunker somewhere.
Well, I was glad nothing happened then. We're actually having a viewing party here because there's a group that has worked a lot on it, and yeah, I'm probably 100 times less nervous than any of those people who have spent, you know, hours and hours of their time building this thing, but it should all go according to plan, knock on wood. So that'll do it for the Twitter segment this week, and let's dive right into it with our chat with Sean here. So Sean, I guess just to start off, what kind of led you to where you are now? How did you get into weather, and how did you get into teaching meteorology?
Good questions. How much time do you have? Weather, I actually originally wanted to be an astronomer. And then in high school, there are two things. First of all, the blizzard of 96, I was a sophomore in high school, and lived in Central Jersey. And that had a big impact on me. I just couldn't stop watching the Weather Channel. I think a lot of meteorology majors have similar stories, but that sort of, school was closed for 3 days, and I just became fascinated by it, and started to really look into universities where they had it as a major. So that was really what got me into weather. Teaching is a more long-winded story. I was definitely, when I was at Cornell, I definitely knew I wanted to go to grad school, but I actually took a year off after Cornell because I mostly it was just burnout. I needed a breather before I went to grad school, so I deferred for a year. And then when I eventually, long story short, when I finished my PhD, I swore I'd never go into academia. Because I was tired of it. So I worked in the private sector for, it wasn't even that long. It was maybe 6 months. And I didn't like the fact that I was just sitting at a computer programming all the time. And by then, the exhaustion from academia had worn off. And a job opened up late at the University of Kansas. They were looking for a two-year contract, basically a fill-in. They called it a visiting assistant professor. So I applied on a whim and actually got it. I moved out to Kansas within 3 weeks and got there about a week before the semester started. And that's how I got into it, and eventually ended up here starting in 2013 in a tenure track position. So that's the short version of the story.
So I have so many questions about that, because I'm kind of at that moment in my life where I'm like, you know, what the heck am I going to do? Academia is kind of crazy. But I'll save that for the post-show chat here. So as you, I guess, have moved from Kansas and now to Embry-Riddle as a teacher, what are some of the things that you've learned about teaching, whether it's specific to meteorology or not specific to meteorology, that's kind of super important for you to do as a teacher?
There's a couple things. It really depends what you're teaching. So there's a huge difference between teaching, say, an intro weather class, which tend to be of bigger size, and you have a lot of people in there who aren't meteorology or atmospheric science majors. And then, so there's a difference between that and teaching more advanced classes. For the intro classes, the biggest thing I ever learned was from really the person who taught me how to teach. He was a postdoc at McGill while I was a student, and I was his TA for a lot of years. And he said that the thing you have to remember when you're teaching intro classes is it's half teaching, half circus entertainment. So that's when I teach an intro class, I mean, you can't PowerPoint them to death, right? Students will even write, you know, in some end of semester feedback, death by PowerPoint. You're always going to get a few of those. But I think the best advice I have is really to mix it up. And, you know, we have some tools here where you can actually, they're called clickers. There's different varieties of them, but you can actually put questions on the screen and have students use these electronic clickers to respond to them. And that keeps them engaged. I do a bunch of labs. We do a lab on the roof, an observation lab, where we actually take weather instruments up to the roof. And they take measurements. That's pretty popular. And to be honest with you, a lot of times I'll just break up a lecture, especially in an intro class, by showing a funny video, usually of a TV meteorologist saying or doing something funny. The Cantori thunder snow videos are very popular. That's a lot what I do with the intro class. With the more advanced classes, or even with grad classes, I think my number one rule, and I think it's easier just because my synoptics is my focus, so I think it's easier with things like that. But my number one rule is to just use real-time weather as much as I can. You know, schematics and historical examples are useful, but making sure that people are aware of the real-time weather, and also making students present it to you. So like in my advanced forecasting class, I have, after the first week, they do all the weather discussions and they take turns, and you know, it's usually one group per class, but it's a lot more useful for them, I think, than listening to me go on and on about the weather. So those are the main things I think I've learned over the years. And also you get better with repetition. But by the same time, you know, you teach a class more than once helps, but by the same token, you don't want it to get stale. So it's a balance between sort of improving with repetition, but also making sure your materials stay up to date and current and incorporate new findings and things like that.
I'm curious, if you were to look back on the first lecture you ever gave as a associate professor or assistant professor, would anything stand out to you that maybe you weren't doing at the time that you now have kind of taken on as a philosophy?
First of all, I was a nervous wreck. In fact, it's still kind of a joke among students from Kansas who are in that class about how nervous I was that day. But I would say the number one thing is involve the students more, even if it was a lecture. Like, for example, I think that was METAR code. There's you know, you can't really give a discussion on METAR code, but at least break it up and show real-time examples and, you know, make students come up and write a METAR code on the board as they get more comfortable with it or things like that. So involve the students more, make it more interactive, even if it is a lecture in the discussion class. I think that's the main takeaway.
Gotcha. And we, on Twitter, someone, I'm going to butcher the name, but Corrales?
Corrales, yeah. Yeah.
Corrales. She tweeted and said you were definitely important for me. She was talking to you. So that's really cool to see that you have this kind of impact on.
That type of stuff keeps me going in the job. It's always good to hear from students, whether current or alumni. I mean, she graduated in the spring and now is working on her master's in, I think, journalism. But it's always cool to hear from students who moved on to whether it's grad school or jobs in various sectors and things like that, and hear that you know they learned something or that you made an impact. That's I think that was another reason I really, after the grad school hangover wore off, that I was really interested in going back to and staying in academia. There's more interaction than I found there was in the private sector, and there's more of a, well, at least in my opinion, a more of a lasting impact. But I really appreciate the sort of getting to interact with people on a daily basis and, you know, in some cases, keeping those connections for a long time.
Yeah, it's always cool to see that. And Tyler and I have had a professor, John Neese, who kind of did that for us. And I won't speak for Tyler, but if he wasn't there as a teacher, I mean, I don't know how. I learned so much from him. And he taught us, I think, 3 classes. And just in those 3 classes, I probably learned more in those 3 classes than any of my other classes, because he was such a good teacher. And he knew how to engage you, and he was very, he knew the science too, which is a big part of it.
It was like the concrete foundation. Go ahead, Tyler. Foundation. I still have the labs in the exams, and I haven't looked at them in a while. I might actually try to do one in a few weeks. fond memories. What I remember is, a lot of people didn't really look forward to them, but I was always confident that if you made sense of everything and you thought things through, that you could get the answer right. And the best thing about his questions was, you know, he would always try to make sure that it wasn't an easy question, but it was one that made you think. If you could think through things, you'd get it right. And I still use those skills to this day.
And they're very, very applicable, I feel like. It was like, okay, this is a situation that I've seen before on like a satellite imagery or radar or something. And when you can apply something to what's actually happening and what you've seen before, I think you learn a lot. Yeah. At least I learned a lot from those kind of.
And probably I'm laughing because I remember we'd review the exams. He would be honestly upset if the average was below a certain number, as if the teaching wasn't getting through.
I kind of get like that too, to be honest. I don't, if the average is sort of atypical for what I've had in the past, I don't really question the students. I question myself. It's more like what did I not do this year? Or what did I not do correctly this year compared to previous years? So I can totally vouch for that.
Yeah, that's refreshing to hear, because I don't know, not everyone's like that. And I think it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you also do some research down there, I presume. I saw that. That you mentioned a little bit. I guess how much time? What's the time allocation for that? Because what I saw in in undergrad was the time people the teachers were definitely not spending as much time on teaching than would have been good for the students. But that's just kind of how academia is sometimes. How do you balance those two things?
Right. That's an excellent question. Not an easy answer. It really depends on where you are. I mean, certainly when I was in grad school, and McGill's kind of a mid-sized program, but, you know, the professors were primarily research focused. A number of classes were taught by postdocs or research associates. They weren't taught by professors. The course load at most, for a professor at most research-based institutions, is usually no more than three courses a year. Some of them are just one per semester. So now where I am now, it's essentially the opposite. We're traditionally a teaching-focused institution. And also our meteorology program is undergraduate only. So we can spend more time on teaching and also on undergraduates. By the same token, our course load is three per semester, which is high. I mean, there aren't that many who have that high. So finding time to do research is difficult. In a place like where I am now. I mean, I managed to do it, but I certainly don't do as much of it as I would, at a more research-focused institution, and B, if we had a graduate program. So there are opportunities to go both ways, and there are some schools that are middle ground. When you generally think of the big meteorology program, you know, Colorado State, Washington, Wisconsin, those type of programs. It's generally research focused, and teaching is a secondary concern. But it really, the biggest factor is where you go and what the priority of the university and the department are.
So what kind of classes do you teach?
So we have, because we're an aeronautical university, so we're actually I think we're still the leading aerospace institution in the country. So everyone who comes here to be a pilot, a professional pilot, they have to take two weather classes. So those are our service courses. So they have to take introductory meteorology, which I teach usually in the fall. And then they have to take intro to aviation weather, which is I usually teach in the spring. And then we have our own meteorology majors. So for those people, I teach sort of an intro analysis and forecasting class where we learn how to isopleth and draw station plots and SKUTs and things like that. And then I teach advanced synoptic and forecasting. And that's the class I was kind of referring to earlier, where they basically give their own weather discussions every time we meet, and also we do some theory as well. So we do QG theory and potential vorticity and things like that. So that one's kind of a mix. But I've taught. I recently started teaching a climate dynamics class, which we just added to the curriculum. I think it'll be every other spring. And I've also taught our thunderstorms class. And then last summer we added a storm chasing class, which we're not allowed to call it storm chasing because the university lawyers get upset. But it's basically a lot of universities do it. I know University of Illinois and College of DuPage have done it forever. But we took 9 students for 2 weeks out to the plains, and it was a 3-credit class, and they had to do research projects when they got back, but we were there like for the Dodge City tornadoes in late May, and that whole week where we basically chased. We were fortunate last summer. So I like teaching new different classes, but that's sort of the recap of what I teach here.
Yeah, I'd say getting lucky for that. I guess it's not luck, but that's a really nice week to be out there this summer.
Yeah, they were. I sort of had this reputation as being of a tornado curse before that. So there had been several big events when I lived in Kansas that I either couldn't go or went to the wrong place for various reasons. But that last summer was the curse.
The curse has been lifted. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what, I guess, taking a group of students out chasing, are you, I would feel so much responsibility and that would, I don't know, that seems kind of scary to have that much responsibility. What is it like to take a group out chasing like that?
What you said. you have to be careful. You have to be safety first. I'm generally a pretty cautious chaser to begin with, so I don't think it was a huge adjustment for me, but you have to sort of make the rules clear and make sure that you always have an escape route, right? I mean, the number one goal is to survive. It's not to see the tornado. And it's to keep everyone in one piece. Like that Dodge City Day, I mean, obviously, I'm sure you guys know it's become so popular that you get into these chaser traffic jams and stuff like that. But, I mean, there were cars flying by us, while we were pulled over on a side road, and they had red and blue flashing lights, and they weren't police. They were just chasers who sort of were pretending to be police. They could get ahead. So it's become it's changed a lot since I first started doing it, and that's not that long ago. It's only 10 years ago, but it's changed a lot. And how many people think they can do it and kind of do it by themselves, and it's a race to get the best pictures. But with a class, in addition to staying safe, I mean, you want them to feel like they helped forecast for the right spot, right? So that's almost as big an achievement as actually seeing the storm. So I think that's something we also try to keep in mind is, making sure they feel involved in the decision-making. But yeah, it's a stressor. You worry about safety and you're always, sort of keep in the back of your mind, well, what's the scariest situation I can get into today and how do I get out of it, basically, is what you try to remember.
How important is that that hands-on experience and actually seeing the storm and forecasting the storm that you saw? How important is that to their education?
I think it's invaluable. I mean, we've done it. So we did it with that. And then we also had the Doppler on wheels here the previous summer for 2 weeks studying local convection. And it was, I mean, obviously it wasn't super cellular, but it was the same idea. You forecast and you position the radar and then you measure the data. There have been a lot of social science studies that have shown sort of this hands-on experiential learning is really advantageous. And also it gives them a leg up if they want to be a forecaster, it gives them a leg up on a job application. And also if they want to do grad school, it says you were involved with certain things while you were an undergrad that were different. So I think it helps a lot. And I think all of them last year, even the ones who we actually had two who weren't meteorology majors, they were aeronautical science majors, but meteorology minors. And I think they all learned a lot on how to forecast, what to look for. And also, you can't replicate the visual cues for a severe storm in the classroom, right? I mean, seeing the striations in the supercell and the wall cloud and the mammatus, you can't replicate that. So I think it's hugely advantageous. In fact, it's to the point now where we're going to offer it every year, and we're getting pretty high demand for it. So yeah, I think if every school did it, it would be a boon to their enrollments and to the undergraduate and graduate experience.
So you're based in Daytona Beach. What was Hurricane Matthew like?
I escaped to Atlanta. it was dicey. I personally evacuated, but school wise, it was very dicey. Our biggest, in addition to getting students out, we have a giant fleet of aircraft. Because you know we have students who get their certifications and stuff. So we have about 40 aircraft, and they had to fly all of those out. I think they flew them to Auburn, Alabama, and housed them there. And then there was the question of students who didn't have anywhere to go. They ended up being put in county shelters. And so it was a dicey situation. And the storm, I mean, it was a Cat 4, but the winds, the Cat 3, Cat 4 winds really only extended out about 40 to 50 miles. So it was, you know, the models kept bouncing back and forth between making landfall and not making landfall. And despite the NHC continuity, a lot of people these days go on one or two model runs and, you know, will freak out or not freak out depending upon what they say. So it was a dicey few days. In retrospect, I mean, this area wasn't hit that hard. It was, power was the biggest issue. It was out for 2 days-ish in most places. Some areas to the north, St. Augustine, saw a lot of surge flooding at high tide. And then, of course, there was the flooding in North Carolina, which I think ended up being the worst damage in the whole storm. But this is not, people think of Florida as hurricane country, but this is not a part of Florida that sees a lot of hurricanes. The fact that the coast kind of bends inward towards the northwest has protected this area for a long time. So it was an unusual event, that's for sure.
And you've only been there since 2013, so you haven't really had to deal with that many storms. You're not in there are a lot of people down there that are, it's the same situation, even if they've been there for 5+ years. Do you see, did you see with Matthew, people not really knowing how to respond, or did people generally take the right precautions?
I would say more took the right precautions than not, but there is a big problem in Florida, having not had a major landfall since 2005, where we have a huge migration of people moving down here, who've never experienced a strong hurricane. So there were a lot of people who definitely stuck it out and probably got lucky in that the worst of it remained offshore. But in a different situation, it would have been exponentially worse. So I think education and, you know, keeping people aware and making sure they trust the right outlets, especially in this day and age of information coming at you from everywhere, is important. But there's definitely a large segment that don't take it seriously because they've never really experienced it because it's been such a drought for U.S. landfalls.
So each week we ask our guest the same question at the end of the show, and you should have a very good answer given that you're a meteorologist and you teach students and you seem to enjoy it. And the question is, for people that may be considering studying meteorology or for those that are already studying meteorology, what would your advice be to them?
Wow, that's a loaded question. Number one thing is diversify yourself. And what I mean by that is, whether you're an undergraduate or graduate, try to at least become acquainted with as many tools and subfields of meteorology as you can. So like for students who are undergraduates in our program, we have minors in things like emergency management and GIS. Try to acquire skills that make you stand out. And that can be more than one skill. But it's not just about forecasting is sort of the thing that, you know, machines are replacing people pretty rapidly in forecasting. But there are other subfields, whether it's risk management or emergency management, GIS, mapping, reinsurance. There are other things, climate obviously is a big one, where you can make yourself stand out. And the more you do that, and the earlier you start, the better. And along with that goes internships. Don't just focus on your GPA or your on-campus, sort of your extracurricular on-campus thing. A lot of students, and that stuff is great. It does look good on applications. Making sure you get professional experience through an internship, whether it's broadcast or private or government, whatever it is important. You know, so whatever you want to do, start early and get as much diverse experience as you can. I know that was one thing I regretted in hindsight, was sort of limiting myself to Synoptics. And it was, I've honestly learned a lot more teaching than as a student. That might sound strange, but that's kind of how it went for me. So I encourage people to sort of get as much experience as they can, as early as they can.
Diversify and acquire skills that make you stand out. Some spot on advice there, Sean. Thanks for joining us tonight. And we hope to have you back on sometime in the future.
Oh yeah. Thanks very much for having me. I had a blast. Appreciate it.
And thanks everyone for listening tonight. If you're not already following us on Twitter or Facebook, you can follow us at the WX Junkies. You can listen to this podcast on SoundCloud, YouTube, iTunes. If you're over on iTunes, go ahead and give us a rating or review. We'd really appreciate it. And Tyler, we don't have a show next week, but what can we expect in the future weeks?
Next week's Thanksgiving, so we decided we'd take a week off, and we hope that you we'll accept that. I can't remember the last time we had a week off, but our next show will be in 2 weeks, and that'll be December 1st on a Thursday. And so it's 2 weeks away. And do we have a guest for that show, Dakota?
I don't think so, but one thing that will be coming in the future is we're going to do a collaboration with Weather Hype, Min and Castle, who run Weather Hype. We're going to be on their show, and then they're going to come on our show sometime in December. So it could be the next show, but at least before the next year, we'll be collaborating with them. And also something to note, we've been doing this podcast for a year now. November marks the year.
Do you have the exact date?
No, I don't. It's we've done 49 episodes, and I think we only took off. Yeah, we only took off 3 weeks. And so I think mid-November was like one of our first shows. I don't know. You could look on YouTube, I think, to figure out the exact date. But actually, we took off more than 3 weeks, I think. But
Four more shows in the year in December. I will be working on a few guests. Dakota will be working on a few guests, probably two each for the rest of 2016. So we're excited about that. Have a great Thanksgiving with friends and family, and we'll see you back here on December 1st. So for Sean, Dakota, and myself, thank you for listening to this episode of The Weather Junkies, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.